వక్రతుండ మహాకాయ సూర్యకోటి సభప్రభా నిర్విఘ్నం కురు మే దేవ సర్వకార్యషు సర్వదా శివశక్త్యాయుక్తో యది భవతి శక్తః ప్రభవితుం న చేదేవం దేవో న ఖలు కుశలః స్పందితుమపి అతస్త్వామారాధ్యా హరిహర విరించాదిభిరపి ప్రణంతుం స్తోతుం వా కతమకృత పుణ్యః ప్రభవతి.
Sri Sairam. At the outset, my most loving and prayerful salutations at the divine lotus feet of our most beloved Bhagwan, Sri Satya Sai Baba. Dear listener, you are tuned to Radio Sai Global Harmony on Asia Stream, bringing you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, the love and the message of Bhagwan, Sri Satya Sai Baba. Good morning. Greetings and loving Sairam on this Thursday, on the 2nd of July 2020, and with me Team Radio Sai Sunil welcoming you to this morning's segment, Divine Glory on Thursday Live from Prashanthinilayam, coming to you from the Sri Satya Sai Media Center here at Prashanthinilayam. Let me first read out to you today's Sai Inspires message. What is the mark of a cultured and educated person? Bhagwan lovingly reminds us today, and I quote, "Inner cleanliness, keeping the mind and the intellect serene and sacred, free from dirt, is very important for a seeker. When thoughts and feelings are impure and agitated, you cannot be calm and happy. When the mind is polluted, reactions are polluted. To keep the mind clean, you must empathetically analyze situations involving others and their activities, and then decide on how to respond to them. Do not rush to draw conclusions. Following others' reactions is not desirable. One must resolve on any action only after intelligent discrimination and inquiry. Some of our people are doing this, so we will do it too. This attitude is mean and demeaning. It is a sign of weakness. It is the consequence of basic ignorance. Sheep behave in that manner. Born as people, moving about as educated persons, yet stupidly following others as sheep, as sheep do, and polluting the minds with the ideas borrowed from the lips of others. These things are to be avoided." Unquote. This was taken from Vidya Vahini, chapter 16. Dear listener, let me now play for you a song sung by Swami's devotees. And the singer in this song is so cute. And the song, and this song extols Bhagwan as Gurunatha, as Sai Gurunatha. Please enjoy this song. Sai Ram, dear listener, that was a song from the album Sri Satya Sai Geetamalu. Today, the world is still continuing with lockdowns and social distancing due to the spread of the coronavirus disease, or the COVID-19. And let us all take all the precautions mandated by the government and the health department, and also maintain personal and community hygiene. Also, let us engage in prayers at our own places. Talking about prayers, let me now play for you the Krimi Mantra, which is popularly known as Krimi Mantra. And this mantra is from the Krishna Yajurveda Taittiriya Aranyaka. And the efficacy of this mantra is in destroying all the harmful germs and viruses. And here it is.
Om Atrinatva Krime Hanmi Kanvena Jamadagnina Vishvavaso Brahmana Hataha Krimina Gumraja Apyesha Vistapatir Hataha Atho Mata Atho Pita Atho Sthura Atho Kshudra Atho Krishna Atho Shveta Atho Ashatika Hata Shveta Bhissaha Sarve Hata Ahara Vadya Shrutasya Havisho Yata Tat Satyam Yadamiyamasya Jambhayo Adadami Tatahitate Khantan Rasi Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
Sai Ram, dear listener, this mantra is chanted daily in the morning and the evening prayer sessions here at Prashanthi Nilayam. And for those of you who don't know, let me tell you that these prayer sessions are streamed live for all our listeners on Radio Sai's YouTube channel. Sorry, Radio Sai's Prashanthi Mandir Live YouTube channel, Sri Satya Sai Baba Facebook page, and of course Radio Sai's Asia stream and Telugu streams, both in the morning at 8 a.m. and in the evening at 5 p.m. So you could log on at these times. The time right now in our studios is 56 minutes past 9 a.m. That is Indian Standard Time. And today in Divine Glory, I have lined up for you readings from the English version of the holy book, Sri Sai Satcharitra, written by Sri Hemant Pant, followed by a conversation with Dr. Srikant Sola, a renowned cardiologist who was serving at the Sri Satya Sai Institute of Higher Medical Sciences, Whitefield, Bengaluru. This is taken from our archives, and in conversation with him is Professor G. Venkatraman, the former Vice Chancellor of the Sri Satya Sai Institute of Higher Learning, and also the former director of Radio Sai. But first, readings from Sri Sai Satcharitra. Sri Sai Satcharitra is an account on the life and teachings of Sai Baba of Shirdi, written by Sri Hemant Pant. We are thankful to Vasanti Sundaram for reading out the contents from this holy book, and to Veeramani Kannan for the melodious musical support. Wishing you all a happy, holy and blessed Thursday and a wonderful day ahead. Praying to Lord Almighty that the pandemic caused by the coronavirus disease be eradicated and all the suffering come to an end at the earliest. Samasta Lokaha Sukhino Bhavantu.
Chapter 38. Baba's Handi, Disrespect of Shrine, Cup of Buttermilk. In the last chapter, we described Baba's Shavadi procession. In this, we take up Baba's Handi or cooking pot and some other subjects. Preliminary. O blessed Sadguru Sai, we bow to you, who has given happiness to the whole world, accomplished the welfare of the devotees, and have removed the affliction of those who have resorted to your feet. By being very liberal and also being the protector and savior of the bhaktas who surrender themselves to you, you have incarnated yourself in this world to oblige the mankind and do them good. The liquid essence of pure self was poured into the mold of Brahma, and out of this has come out the crest jewel of the saints, Sai. This Sai is Atmaram himself. He is the abode of the perfect divine bliss. After having attained himself all objects of life, he made his devotees established on the path. Baba's Handi. Different sadhanas are prescribed in our scriptures for different ages. Tapa is recommended for Krita age, Dhyan for Treta age, Yajna for Dwapara age, and Dan for Kali Yuga. Of all the charities, giving food is the best one. We are much perturbed when we get no food at noon. Other beings feel similarly under such circumstances. After knowing this, he who gives food to the poor and the hungry is the best donor or charitable person. The Taittiriya Upanishad says, food is Brahma. From food all the creatures are born, and by food they live. And after having departed into food again, they enter. When an atithi comes to your door at noon, it is our duty to welcome him by giving him food. Other kinds of charities, namely giving away wealth, property and clothes, require some discrimination. But in the matter of food, no such consideration is necessary. If anybody comes to our door at noon, he should be served forthwith. And if lame, crippled, blind and diseased persons come, they should be fed first, and the able-bodied persons and our relatives later. The merit of feeding the former is much greater than that of feeding the latter. Other kinds of charities are imperfect without this annadan, just as stars without the moon, necklace without its pendant, crown without its pinnacle, pond without a lotus, bhajan without devotion, married lady without the kumkumar, song without a sweet voice, or buttermilk without salt. Just as Varan excels all other dishes, annadan is the best of all merits. Now, let us see how Baba prepared food and distributed it to others. It has been stated before that Baba required very little food for himself, and whatever little he wanted was obtained by begging from a few houses. But when he decided to distribute food to all, he made preparations himself. He depended on nobody and troubled none in this matter. First, he went to the bazaar and bought all the things like corn, flour, spices by paying cash. He also did the grinding in the open courtyard of the masjid. He arranged a big hearth, and after lighting a fire, he kept a handi over it with a proper measure of water. There were two kinds of handis, one small and the other big. The former provided food for 50 persons, the latter for 100. Sometimes he cooked meethe chawal, sweet rice, and at other times biryani with meat. At times in the boiling varan, he let in small balls of thick or flat bread of wheat flour. He grinded the spices on a stone slab and put thin pulverized spices into the cooking pot. He took all the pains to make the dishes very palatable. He prepared ambil by boiling jwari flour in water and later mixing it to buttermilk, and then boiled both together. With the food, he distributed this ambil to all alike. To see whether the food was properly cooked or not, Baba rolled up the sleeve of his kafni and put his bare arm in the boiling cauldron without fear, and churned the whole mass from side to side and up and down. There was no mark of burn on his arm, nor fear on his face. When the cooking was over, Baba got the pots in the masjid and had them duly consecrated by the Maulvi. First, he sent part of the food as prasad to Mahasapati and Tathya Patil, and then he served the remaining contents with his own hand to all the poor and helpless people to their heart's content. Really blessed and fortunate must be those people who got food prepared by Baba and served by him. Somebody may raise a point here and ask, Did Baba distribute vegetarian and non-vegetarian food as prasad to all his devotees? The answer is plain and simple. Those who were accustomed to non-vegetarian food were given non-veg food from the handi as prasad. And those who were not so accustomed were given vegetarian meals. There is a principle that when a guru himself gives anything as prasad, the disciple who thinks and doubts whether it's acceptable or otherwise goes to perdition. In order to see whether any disciple has imbibed this principle, Baba at times put them to test. For instance, on an Ekadashi day, he gave some rupees to Dada Kelkar and asked him to go in person to Korhala to get meat from there. This Dada Kelkar was an orthodox Brahmin and stuck to all orthodox manners in his life. He knew that offering wealth, grain and clothes to a Sadguru was not enough, but that implicit obedience to him and prompt compliance with his order was a real dakshina that pleased him most. So Dada Kelkar dressed himself and started for the place. Then Baba called him back and said, "Don't go yourself, send somebody else." Then Dada sent his own servant Pandu for the purpose. When Baba saw him going, he asked Dada to call him back and cancelled the program. On another occasion, Baba asked Dada just to see how saltish the biryani was done. The latter replied casually, "It was all right." Then Baba said to him, "Neither have you seen it with your own eyes, nor tasted it with your tongue. Then how could you say it was good? Just take off the lid and see." While saying this, Baba caught his arm and thrust it into the pot and added, "Take some out of this, leaving aside your orthodox ways. Taste a little." When a wave of real love rises in a mother's mind, she pinches her child. And when he begins to cry, she hugs him close to her bosom. Similarly, Baba, in a true motherly way, pinched Dada Kelkar in this way. Really, no saint or guru will ever force his orthodox disciple to eat food forbidden in his religion. The handi business went on for some time till 1910 and was stopped thereafter. As stated before, Das Ganu spread the fame of Baba by his kirtans far and wide in the Mumbai Presidency, and people from that part of the country began to flock to Shirdi, which became very soon a place of pilgrimage. The devotees brought with them various articles for presentation and offered various dishes of food as naivedya. The quantity of naivedya offered by them was so much the fakirs and paupers could feed themselves to their heart's content, leaving some surplus behind. Before stating how naivedya was distributed, we shall refer to Nana Saheb Chandorkar's story showing Baba's regard for local shrines and deities. Nana Saheb's disrespect of a shrine. By drawing inferences or guessing in their own way, some people said that Sai was a Brahmin and some said he was a Muslim. In reality, he belonged to no caste. No one knew definitely when he was born and in what community and who his parents were. Then how could he be a Muslim or a Brahmin? If he was a Muslim, how could he keep his dhuni ever burning in the masjid? How could there be a Tulsi Vrindavan there? How could he allow the blowing of conches and the ringing of bells? How could he allow all the different forms of Hindu worship there? Had he been a Muslim, could he have ears pierced? And could he have spent money from his pocket for repairing Hindu temples? On the contrary, he never tolerated the slightest disrespect to shrines and deities. Once, Nana Saheb Chandorkar came to Shirdi with his sadhu, husband of his wife's sister, Mr. Biniwale. When they went to masjid and sat before Baba, the latter suddenly got angry with Nana Saheb and said, "You have been so long in my company, then why do you behave like this?" Nana Saheb at first did not understand anything and humbly requested Baba to explain. Baba asked him when did he come to Kopargaon and how he came to Shirdi from there. Nana Saheb then at once realized his mistake. He usually worshipped the shrine of Datta on the banks of the Godavari at Kopargaon on his way to Shirdi. But this time, he dissuaded his relative, who was a Datta Bhakt, from going to that shrine in order to avoid delay and drove straight. He confessed all this to Baba and told him that while bathing in the Godavari, a big thorn went into his foot and gave him much trouble. Baba said that was a slight punishment he met and warned him to be more careful in the future. Kala, hodgepodge. To revert to the distribution of Naivedya. After the Aarti was over and after Baba sent away the people with Udi and blessings, he went inside and sat behind a curtain with his back to the Nimbar for meals, with two rows of the intimate devotees, one on each side. The Bhaktas brought Naivedya containing a variety of food such as puris, mande, polis, basandi, sanza, fine rice, etc., and kept waiting outside for prasad consecrated by Baba. All the foods were mixed in a hodgepodge and placed before Baba. He offered it to the gods and consecrated it. Then, portions of the same were given to the persons waiting outside and the rest was served to the group of devotees inside with Baba at the center. The Bhaktas sitting in two rows then dined to their heart's content. Baba asked Shama and Nana Sahib Nimonkar daily to serve the consecrated food to all the persons sitting inside and look to their individual needs and comforts. This they did very carefully and willingly. Every morsel of the food thus partaken gave them fulfillment and satisfaction. Such sweet, lovely and consecrated food it was, ever auspicious and ever holy. Cup of buttermilk. Once Hemad Pant had eaten to his full capacity in this company when Baba offered him a cup of buttermilk. Its white appearance pleased him, but there was no space for it. He, however, took only a sip on seeing his faltering attitude. Baba said, "Drink it all. You will not get such opportunity hereafter." Hemad Pant drank it all off then and found that Baba's words were prophetic, for he passed away after a brief period. Now, readers, we have certainly to thank Hemad Pant. He drank the cup of buttermilk, but has supplied us with sufficient quantity of nectar in the form of Baba's leelas. Let us drink this nectar to our heart's content and be satisfied and happy. Bow to Sri Sai. Peace be to all. Chapter 39. Baba's knowledge of Sanskrit. His interpretation of a verse from Gita. Construction of the Samadhi Mandir. This chapter deals with Baba's interpretation of a verse from the Bhagavad Gita. As some people believe that Baba had little knowledge of Sanskrit, but by the interpretation of Nana Sahib Chandurkar's question, Hemad Pant refuted that charge in chapter number 50. And as it deals with the same subject matter, it is incorporated in this chapter. Preliminary. Blessed is Shirdi and blessed is Dwarka Mai, where Sri Sai lived and moved until he took his Mahasamadhi. Blessed are the people of Shirdi, whom he obliged and for whom he lived there. Shirdi was a small village first, but it attained importance on account of his contact and became a Tirtha, holy place of pilgrimage. Equally blessed are the women folk of Shirdi. Blessed is their whole and undivided faith in him. They sang the glories of Baba while bathing, grinding, pounding corn and doing other household work. Baba's interpretation. Nobody believed that Baba knew Sanskrit. One day, he surprised all by giving an interpretation of a verse from the Gita to Nana Sahib Chandurkar. A brief account about this matter was written by Mr. B.B. Dev, retired Mamlatdar, and published in Marathi in Sri Sai Leela magazine, volume 4. Short accounts of the same are also published in Sai Baba, page 36, both by B.B. Nrisimha Swami. Mr. B.B. Dev has also given an English version of this in a statement dated 27-9-1936 and published on page 66 of Devotee's Experience, part 3 by Nrisimha Swami. As Mr. Dev has got first-hand information about this subject from Nana Sahib himself, we give below his version. Nana Sahib Chandorkar was a good student of Vedanta. He had read Gita with commentaries. He fancied that Baba knew nothing of Sanskrit texts. So, Baba one day pricked the bubble. These were the days before crowds flocked to Baba, when Baba had individual meetings at the mosque with such devotees. Nana was sitting near Baba and massaging his legs and muttering something under his breath. Here is a dialogue between Baba and Nana. Baba: Nana, what are you mumbling yourself? Nana: I'm reciting a shloka. Baba: What shloka? Nana: From the Bhagavad Gita. Baba: Say it loudly. Nana then recited Bhagavad Gita chapter 4 verse 34, which is as follows: Tatvidhi pranipatena pariprashnena sevaya upadekshanti te jnanam jnanina satatva darshina. Baba: Nana, do you understand that? Nana: Yes. Baba: If you do, then tell me its meaning. Nana: It means this: making shashtanga namaskar, that is prostration, asking the guru, serving him, learn what this knowledge is. Then those who have attained the real knowledge of the Sadvastu or Brahma will give you upadesh of knowledge. Baba: Nana, I do not want this sort of collected purport of the whole stanza. Give me each word, its grammatical force and meaning. Then Nana explained word by word. Baba: Nana, is it enough to merely make prostration? Nana: I do not know any other meaning for the word pranipat than making prostration. Baba: What is pariprashna? Nana: Asking questions. Baba: What does prashna mean? Nana: The same, questioning. Baba: If pariprashna means the same as prashna, why did Vyasa add the prefix pari? Was Vyasa off his head? Nana: I do not know of any other meaning for the word pariprashna. Baba: Seva. What sort of seva is meant? Nana: Just what we are doing to you. Baba: Is it enough to render such service? Nana: I do not know what more is signified by the word seva. Baba: In the next line, upadekshyanti te jnanam, can you read any other word instead of jnanam? Nana: Yes. Baba: What word? Nana: Ajnanam. Baba: Taking that word instead of jnan, is any meaning made out of this verse? Nana: No, Shankara Bhashya gives no such construction. Baba: Never mind if he does not. Is there any objection to using the word agyan if it gives a better sense? Nana: I do not understand how to construe by placing agyan in it. Baba: Why does Krishna refer Arjun to Tattvadarshis to do his prostration, interrogation and service? Was not Krishna a Tattvadarshi, in fact, Gyan itself? Nana: Yes, he was. But I do not make out why he referred Arjun to Gyanis. Baba: Have you not understood this? Nana was humiliated. His pride was knocked down. Then Baba began to explain. It is not enough merely to prostrate before the Gyanis. We must make Sarvasva Sharanagati, complete surrender to the Sadguru. Mere questioning is not enough. The question must not be made with any improper motive or attitude, or to trap the Guru and catch mistakes in the answer, or out of idle curiosity. It must be earnest with a view to achieve spiritual progress or liberation. Seva is not rendering service with a feeling that one is free to offer or refuse service. One must feel that he is not the master of the body, that the body is Guru's and exists merely to render service to him. If this is done, the Sadguru will show you what the knowledge referred to in the previous stanza is. Nana did not understand what is meant by saying that a guru teaches a gyan. Baba, how is gyan updesh, that is, imparting of realization, to be effected? Destroying ignorance is gyan. Removal of ignorance is, O Arjun, if dream and sleep disappear, you are yourself. It is like that, says the Bhagavad Gita. It also says, is there anything different or independent in gyan besides the destruction of ignorance? Expelling darkness means light. Destroying duality means non-duality. Whenever we speak of destroying dvaita, we speak of advaita. Whenever we talk of destroying darkness, we talk of light. If we have to realize the advaita state, the feeling of dvaita in ourselves has to be removed. That is the realization of the advaita state. Who can speak of advaita while remaining in the dvaita state? Unless one gets into that state of non-duality, how can one know it and realize it? Again, the shishya or the disciple, like the Satguru, is the embodiment of gyan. The difference between the two lies in the attitude, high realization and unrivaled capacity and Aishwarya Yoga or divine powers. The Satguru is Nirgun, Sat Chit Anand. He has indeed taken human form to elevate mankind. But his real Nirgun nature is not destroyed thereby, even a bit. His existence or reality, divine power and wisdom remain undiminished. The disciple also is in fact of the same Swarupa, but it is overlaid by the effect of the sanskars of innumerable births in the shape of ignorance, which veils his view that he is Shuddha Chaitanya. As stated therein, he gets the impressions, I am Jiva, a creature meek and poor. The guru has to root out these offshoots of ignorance and has to give upadesh or instructions. To the disciple, held spellbound for endless generations by the ideas of his being a jiva, the guru imparts the teaching, you are God, you are mighty and opulent. Then he realizes that he is God really. The perpetual delusion under which the disciple is laboring, that he is the body, that he is a creature or jiva or ego, that God, Paramatma and the world are different from him, is an ignorance inherited from innumerable past births. From actions based on it, he has derived his joy, sorrows and mixtures of both. To remove this delusion, this error, this root ignorance, he must start the inquiry. How did the ignorance arise? Where is it? And to show him, this is called the Guru's Updesh. The following are the instances of Agyan. I am a Jiva. I am the body. God, world and Jiva are different. I am not God. Not knowing that body is not the soul. Not knowing that God, world and Jiva are one. Unless these errors are exposed to his view, the disciple cannot learn what is God, Jiva, world, body, how they are interrelated and whether they are different from each other or are one and the same. To teach him these and destroy his ignorance is this instruction in Gyan or Agyan. Why should Gyan be imparted to the Jiva? Updesh is merely to show him his error and destroy his ignorance.
Sairam, dear listeners and viewers, and greetings to all of you from Shanti Nilayam. I have the pleasure of having with me here today Dr. Srikant Sola, who works in Swami's hospital in Whitefield. He has got a CV as fat as a Bible, and so if I start talking about him, I can't get to talk to him. So let me just say, he is a cardiologist with a huge heart full of love. And I will let him introduce himself to you, and from there I will take it over to you, doctor. You tell us about yourself and who you are and how you happen to be here.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Sairam, to all the listeners and viewers as well. I'm a cardiologist, as you said, by profession, and was essentially brought up in the United States, was born in India, but moved to the United States with my family when I was about 5 or 6 years of age.
When was that?
That was, 1976, 77 or so. And body's 40 now, 40 years of age now. So all of my studies was there. But from an early age, there's something about me that always wanted to be of service to others, always wanted to help others. And when even just seeing a slight bit of suffering, I would feel like going out and helping in whatever way I could in those small and young ages. That led me to become a physician, eventually become a cardiologist, and then one day I found myself here at Swami's hospital.
Tell me a little bit about your cardiology experience, because before you came here, you did pretty good there, I believe.
Yeah, very fortunate. Very fortunate.
So let us let our listeners hear and see how well you did there. Because all I know is you were in the Who is Who. And that's something.
Sure.
So please tell us about your American experience.
Yeah, I don't want to brag.
No, it's not a question of bragging. It's informing. So
sure.
Nothing wrong with that.
Sure. In high school, I did very well. I had worked very hard, was a very good student, but also a very good athlete. I played a lot of tennis and was very active in the sports within my school. So was trying to...
I couldn't believe you're 40. You look 25 to me.
I think the body keeps young through...
No, I'm not a heart doctor, but you look young. Okay, carry on.
Yeah, so was always trying to seek a balance in whatever I was doing, whether it was in academics, in sports, in community service. And when I joined college, I went to Stanford University, which in those days was considered to be the best undergraduate
I believe
university.
It still is.
Yeah, it's a wonderful place. Wonderful place. It was fantastic being with the best of the best and the brightest of students from all over the world. There, the tradition in those days was that during your summer holidays, especially during your first and second years, typically one would seek out work which was in line or would somehow support your work for your subsequent field of study, whatever that might be. So for me, medicine.
Had you decided what you were going to do when you went to Stanford?
You know, I came into Stanford thinking I was going to be a physicist and that I was going to invent rocket ships.
Physicists don't do that. They go after Higgs particles.
Yeah, and okay, actually, anyway. Once I started the physics, I thought, oh my goodness, this is way too hard for me. So I went.
What? We lost you. I'm a physicist. yes. Anyway, you ended up doing a better job.
Thankfully, with Swami's grace, I went to where I needed to be, or rather, where he needed me to be. But what happened was, as I was looking for this summer work after my first year of college, I came across a unique opportunity, a charity in which students and young people would ride bicycles across the United States from different starting points and all convene in Washington, D.C., the capital of the USA, for charity. We would raise awareness about the development needs for rural areas in the United States as well as in overseas countries, typically in those days Central America and South America, and we would raise funds for grassroots-based development projects. So it was on this ride, as I was riding 100 kilometers per day across the U.S., stopping at different places, speaking
at
different places.
You drove all the way, went on a bicycle from Stanford to Washington, D.C.?
From San Francisco to Washington, D.C.
San Francisco.
5,000 kilometers.
Jesus Christ.
It was a long way.
How many days did it take you?
It was about 9 weeks.
9 weeks.
And we were very, very strong by the end of those 9 weeks. Yeah. But what happened is one day,
you were ready to join, go for Tour de France or something like that?
We were very strong. But that was part of the balance.
Okay.
Academics.
So what happened in Washington, D.C.?
Personal development. What happened is on the way to D.C., when you're riding 100 kilometers a day, 8, 9, 10 hours, you've got a long time to think.
You went alone or with some companion?
With a group of about 19 other people or so.
So you were all riding as a group?
Right. We would ride according to our pace and our style and so forth. And so as I saw different parts of the country, America is a very wealthy country, but there are pockets of deep poverty within that. It's the same, really, unfortunately, in every place. And what I found was that what I wanted to do
our
was to be
our pockets are very big.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
But it's there everywhere.
I know that.
Country,
I know that.
Every place.
That.
Perhaps in some place it's more of a material poverty. In some place it may be more of a spiritual poverty, but it is still there nevertheless. And so what I realized is what I wanted to do was to serve. I didn't know about Swami at that time. I was just 18 years of age. It was only when I was 19 that I came to know about him. But that set the ball rolling. And once I learned about Swami, then my life changed after that.
Okay, now I have to ask you that question. How did you learn about Swami and how did it change you?
Sure. I was a typical Indian kid. Okay. Growing up in the United States.
Did you participate in spelling bee?
No, not like that.
Not like that.
But I did pretty well at Stanford. But what I found was that even though I had all the success that one could ask for at that age, around 19 years of age, going to a good university, doing well academically, having wonderful friends, a good social standing, had a wonderful family, I found that there was something else, but I wasn't quite sure what it was. It just so happened that my second summer of college, after the second year of college, I had some time to be in the mountains of California. Beautiful mountains, not many people go there, just unspoiled wilderness. And I had a chance to be by myself in those mountains. And there I learned to connect with this sense of silence, sense of peace, sense of huge love. I just couldn't describe what it was. I didn't actually know what it was. I could say, is it something? Was it God? Yes, of course it was. But at that age, when you're 19, 20, what do you know? At least for me, growing up in the U.S., I didn't know. But once I heard about Swami, then that was it.
How did you hear about him? That's the real point.
I was traveling to India to meet my grandparents.
You were traveling to India.
Right. And on the way, on a plane, sitting next to me was a gentleman, a Sai devotee, who had a book about Swami. And I just happened to ask him as we were landing in Chennai, so what brings you to India? And he just says, I'm going to see Sai Baba. I said, Sai Baba, I've heard of him. And he showed me a picture on the book. And as soon as I saw that picture, I said, Sai Baba is God.
You said?
I said, inside. And then I knew that. And when I got down from the plane, I told my relatives, Sai Baba lives in Puttaparthi, can we go and see him? That was it. And so on that same trip, we made
can
our first
Can I tell you a couple
Puttaparthi.
Of stories about airplanes and Sai conversion?
Sure.
I'll tell you about a gentleman in Japan. He's a Japanese software engineer. He got a job in working for a company in California. So one day he was flying from Tokyo to San Francisco and he wanted something to read. So he went to the airport bookstall and he picked up a book on Swami in Japanese.
Oh, wow.
And he read it and he was changed. Then he got a job with a software company in Bangalore. so that he could come here on work and sneak to put up a seat for darshan. He was a service coordinator in Japan.
I see.
The other story relates to another distinguished heart doctor from America, Dr. Jeevanandam.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he's not a cardiologist, but a surgeon. And I had the pleasure of interviewing him many, many years ago. And he told me he was once flying from Pittsburgh to Phoenix in Arizona, where his parents were. His mm-hmm. parents were Sai devotees.
Mm.
And he said, I was the typical American kid. I wanted to become rich, have lots of money, fast cars, this, that.
mm-hmm.
He was not at all shy about talking about those things. And he wanted some reading material and just happened here. So I happened, he got hold of a Sai book. That was all that was available about Swami.
Mm-hmm.
On the plane, he was changed. He said, when I got down from the plane in Phoenix, he had to come down this ladder back in those days.
Mm-hmm.
So I was a changed man. Just like that.
High altitude transformation.
That's a good one. For both of them.
Yeah.
And in a sense also for you. So yeah. That's good.
I had been looking. I knew there was something, but I wasn't sure what it was. Remember, I was 18, 19. This was in the early 1990s. Although I was growing up in the United States, in California, there was a lot of spiritual activity around me. Temples were just starting. It's not like how it is today, where there are large Indian communities and large activities. It wasn't like that back in those days. So I didn't have exposure to that. But once I came, everything transformed for me.
Okay, before you, I start asking you about your visit to Puttaparthi, I must tell you for the record that Indian spirituality went to California at the end of the 19th century. Swami Vivekananda went
mm-hmm.
there. He was there in 18-something-something, toward just before the 20th century. And he went to Chicago for the World Parliament of Religions.
Right.
And he stunned the audience with his opening sentence, and then he got invitations left and right. He stayed in America for 3 or 4 years. Okay, now you were telling me that you had decided the moment you saw the photo that you wanted to see Swami,
mm-hmm.
whom you recognized as God.
Right.
So how did that happen?
The first visit, I came with my grandfather. Now
Where was your grandfather living?
Grandfather lives in Andhra Pradesh, in Vijayawada. He was a lawyer in those days.
So from Madras you went to Vijayawada.
Right, went to see my family, mm-hmm. and he's a very elevated soul. He's very spiritually advanced. Many people in that area consider him to be a guru, someone who brings seekers to the light. So he and I went for the very first time, and he told me about Swami. He told me many of the experiences that they had had, Vibhuti, Amrit, interviews, and so forth. In fact, Swami had once in an interview told my grandfather that he is a Jivan Mukta, someone who is liberated while alive. So such a rare soul I had as my close companion, friend, and guide. And it was through my grandfather that I learned meditation. I learned to silence the mind. I learned to go into that quiet state where one finds Swami outside but also inside. And so with that type of guidance, I was really able to take advantage of these visits in those days. In those days, there wasn't much physical interaction with Swami. In fact, it really wasn't until I came here and started working at Swami's hospital that I had more regular interactions. It was always outside. But that outer type of interaction forced me to connect with Swami within, because my visits to India were once a year, but I was in the U.S. the rest of the time, and so
what do you mean by outside? That's what I'm
The physical about. Form of Swami is so enchanting and so beautiful and so wonderful.
That's true, but again,
but in the United States, how is it possible for me to talk and ask Swami a question to get guidance, to really say, how do I live my life here in a way that you
but
want
you know,
me to?
If you don't mind my telling you, you're geographically outside, but actually you are connecting to Swami inside.
Yes, yes.
For us it was the opposite. We were all physically near, but we were outside. I'm not saying this in jest, it's really a fact. So your grandfather has launched you in the right orbit.
Yes.
That's very nice to hear. Yes. Carry on.
Yes. And so that's how I developed. I went to medical school. Mm-hmm. In medical school, I worked very hard.
Medical school in Stanford? Or?
This was in the University of Louisville in Kentucky.
Kentucky.
And during that time, I worked at Stanford and Harvard medical schools for part of my training. Mm-hmm. During that time, I remember one Swami said in discourse, he said that medical students today, if they get 50% marks, they study for a few hours, that is enough. But medical students should study 15 hours a day or so. So in those days, when I heard that, I really studied. I would study 15, 16, 17, 18 hours a day during peak exam time in order to master the material that was present. And our exams were very thorough. As a result of that type of studying and the grace that Swami gave me, I ended up studying at the top of my class, not only on a national level, but on a, I mean, not only on a school level, but on a national level. And that was because of the grace of Swami, the guidance of Swami.
And all along you were quite comfortable working in USA. You didn't think of coming here or anything like that?
No, I had thought of, all I knew was I wanted to serve. I didn't know how, I didn't know where. That was my main focus. And when it came time to specialize, then I thought, what is the best way to help other people? And what I was seeing in the hospital as a medical student in those days were people dropping dead of heart attacks left and right. And so I realized that for me, cardiology was the way to approach that. So I went to my residency training in internal medicine, which is medicine for adults. Then I started my cardiology fellowship, and through that, then I began my work, eventually at the Cleveland Clinic in Cleveland, Ohio.
Cleveland is a sort of
fantastic
place.
It is the hot seat of cardiology.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
And I remember one of my mentors from my fellowship training at Emory University in Atlanta, which itself is a very good institution.
Yeah, I heard of that also.
He was telling me that the Cleveland Clinic, compared to some of the other places, top place in the U.S., the Cleveland Clinic is still a whole stratosphere above any of those places.
Jesus
in terms
Christ,
of quality.
That's something.
And, you know, when I went to see some of these other places, Johns Hopkins, Harvard, Duke, Mayo Clinic, and others, they're all outstanding places, excellent places. People who go there for their medical care should consider them very fortunate because the quality of care is so good. But the physicians, the surgeons, the nurses, the researchers, the team at the Cleveland Clinic was just phenomenal. And the experience that I got there, that was my early professional experience, really was unmatched.
No, I'm just a little curious here as an academic. You said it's phenomenal, this is great. What's the difference between the two, qualitatively and quantitatively?
The difference between the two would be like having a regular car and having a Mercedes-Benz or an Audi. It's such a difference in terms of quality.
That is the what you call the manifestation, but what made it different?
First, the entire focus was on quality. Everything that we did should be just perfect in terms of how we treat patients, how we diagnose patients, how we do surgery, how we do research. Everything should be just perfect.
In what way were Mayo Clinic and all not that perfect?
They were good.
Yeah, but then what is that extra that you had? That's what I'm trying to find out.
I think was the people that were there. A conglomeration of physicians, surgeons, nurses who all worked very, very hard.
No, but they work hard at Howard.
They do. I think what happens...
No, what I'm trying to get at is, did it have anything to do with the philosophy of medicine, health care, how you relate to the patient, or what was the thing that set you apart from the others?
I think the entire focus was on quality. And quality was such that even
How do you define quality? Because they also... Howard is quality.
Right. How do you define quality? See, there's different ways. You can think of quality in terms of numbers, like mortality, that is death after treatment, complications, what we call morbidity. You can think of quality as in terms of physician experience, the number of cases that you see. Or you can think in quality in terms of the patient experience. How does a patient feel? What does a patient experience when they're coming to a hospital? So at the Cleveland Clinic, the quality encompassed all of these factors. And so what I learned from being there was to be a good physician, to be a good diagnostician, to be good in treatment, to be good in relating to patients through an excellent bedside manner. I learned how to communicate well with other physicians because we had physicians coming from not only all over the country but all over the world. Their physicians would be sending their patients to us for treatment. So we had to treat the patients but also communicate back with those referring physicians so that the care, the high quality care we gave, could be continued even when the patient went home. This required not just giving good treatment, but being a good doctor, but also a good person. That's what I learned
there. Okay, that reminds me of many things, but now you have to talk, so I won't dwell upon that right now. Now, you were in Cleveland from when to when?
From 2005 to 2008.
So spell.
For 3 years. Mm. A lot was achieved, though, in that time.
No, that's true, but what happened in 2008?
2008, I was happy. My family and I were very happy. My boss, Dr. Stephen Nissen, chairman of the Cleveland Clinic at that time, still chairman today, one of the internationally renowned physicians there, he said, "You're one of my departmental superstars." Other colleagues would joke, he said, "Srikanth, if you continue on this track, you're on your way to becoming chairman of the clinic after another 5-10 years. And they would just laugh like that, and I would laugh also. Having gone and spoken at every major conference in cardiology all over the world, I was doing very well, and we were very happy. I published in many papers, had won all sorts of awards for my clinical and research work, etc. Patients would come from all over. Former President Jimmy Carter's staff would come and see me. This president, this prime minister, this king of some country would come. That was the type of patients we were seeing. And then one day, I got an email from the Sathya Sai Center in Cleveland. One of the members had forwarded an email, which was talking about Swami's hospital in Bangalore. And in that email, they were describing a position opening for training for a cardiology fellow doing interventional cardiology. That is the type of person who does stents and angioplasties and so forth. Now, I was already trained, had already been done, but at the end of that email, there was just one single line, and that line said, "Positions for consultant cardiologists are also open." And when I saw that line, it hit me like a thunderbolt. I thought, this is it. This is my chance.
Okay, here I have to interrupt you and ask you a question. 2008, there were 2 hospitals of Swami, one which started in 91 and one which started in 2001. In fact, I was present at the inauguration of both. My question to you is, did you know anything about this? Did you have a casual acquaintance? Did you ever visit those hospitals? Or you came here just for your personal communion with Swami and that was it?
Yeah, it's a good question because most people, when they think about moving to another country, leaving their profession, their current profession, moving to another country, they would go and visit the place where they would be working. They would go and see who are they going to work with, what is the community like, what are the schools like for their kid. Our son was 8 years old at the time. What is their lifestyle, way of living going to be like? We didn't do any of that.
But did you know anything about the hospital? Have you ever been here before?
Sure. We had, in fact, when I was at Duke Medical Center for my residency training, Dr. Mitch Krukoff was one of my attendings. You know him. He helped set up the initial cath labs here in Swami's Super Speciality Hospital in Puttaparthi back in 1991. So through Dr. Krukoff, I tried but somehow couldn't get a position here for residency training during that time. Again, during cardiology fellowship, I tried again to come to Swami's hospitals, but again, somehow it didn't work out. So I worked at the Cleveland Clinic again. I was very happy, but when that opportunity came...
No, you are required to go there and then come.
Exactly. And actually, that is exactly correct. I had to be there. I had to get that experience.
You had to bring dowry with you. Okay.
But that experience had to come, and that was a wonderful experience. And in fact, I'm still in touch with my colleagues there. We have a number of research programs going on. We have a number of educational programs going on. And I continue to learn and train so that I'm always up to date on the latest technology, the latest happenings in healthcare, especially in cardiology.
Now, let's come to your coming to Bangalore. All said and done, Bangalore is not Cleveland. Mm-hmm. In all senses of the word. Despite being a devotee and all that, was it a cultural shock?
It was very different.
Okay, you're diplomatic. That's nice.
Culturally, every organization has its own way of working, right? And so the way of working in Swami's hospital is different from the way of working in the Cleveland Clinic. There it was very much individual-based.
No, that is understandable. Every organization is different. But you know, even the basic practices, the way people relate to each other, that depends on geography, history, and so many things. And did you have any problems with that?
As far as the medical practice, not really, no. I picked up many of the local languages that are spoken by different patients from different
not in terms of the that that's a different that's an important aspect I agree with you, which I overlooked. But what I meant was to be very practical and frank, the work culture in India is very, very different from the work culture in a country like America. I have been there, I have stayed there, and I know the difference. The administrative culture is also very different.
Right.
I'm not going to either support or criticize. We have what we have. It's a product of history and circumstances. These things don't change overnight. But when you go into a setup, there are difficulties. And sometimes people do get affected, they do get dispirited and all that. But facts are facts. In India, I have worked in many establishments, and the levels of what you call efficiency, bureaucracy and all vary from place to place.
Right.
So it does affect people. Right. Do you feel cramped in any way?
I think what happens when people talk about working in a charitable organization, they often equate charity with low quality, unfortunately. And when I went to Bangalore to work there in Swami's hospital, I found that the quality of the work
was tremendous. As far as Swami is concerned, that's the quality is not sacrificed.
Right.
What you're saying
is how do you do the work, though, on a day-to-day basis? What I found was in Bangalore, as well as in Puttaparthi, we follow... So there's certain guidelines for how cardiologists should practice. These guidelines are published by the large cardiology societies from throughout the world, and they're updated quite
frequently. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking of working environment. You know, whether the nurses are as efficient as in those countries.
Right.
Sometimes they hamper. They may not understand what you're seeing because they've been trained differently.
Right.
The hospital practices are not what you're used to. So there are all those difficulties. That doesn't mean that things are bad, but it's a different system, different culture. What I'm trying to say is, did you find that impeding you in any way?
No, not really. Not really. Because we were using the same machines, the same technology, the same way of practice. In fact, what I found very interesting is that having worked at so many big centers in the U.S., especially at the Cleveland Clinic, I thought I had seen pretty much everything there was to see. But once I came to Bangalore, I realized that the severity of disease, the types of cardiovascular illnesses that we were seeing was far more than what I had seen in the U.S. In fact, I learned more after coming to Bangalore than I did when I was in the U.S. I saw stuff there that I'd never seen before. I'd only read about in textbooks and in stages and in mannerisms and types of presentations that I'd never even seen. I had heard about them. I had read about them. But here were patients, and I was taking care of them. Of course, I had many senior physicians to support me, and they're all just wonderful. You know, Dr. Dash, Dr. Barua, and the others, they're just fantastic cardiologists. What I would say is that there are some cultural differences, but I think over time I was able to adapt to those pretty quickly. The thing that makes it so much easier is that the atmosphere is so congenial, so cordial, and so loving that there's a certain sweetness that you see in everyone who works there. And when you have that sweetness, no matter what the differences or different expectations are, that somehow helps to smooth those out so that it makes working there much, much easier.
Dr. Keshav Rao, who used to be in San Francisco, he was our cardiologist here in Puttaparthi. He has since left, he now comes occasionally. Many years ago, we went to the hospital and we interviewed many doctors. And I interviewed him, and he made a remark which is very similar to what you said. He said, when I was in America, I've seen many patients, but all of them came with very similar kind of heart problems, which was the result of the American way of life. Whereas here, we saw a very wide spectrum because all these people came from different strata of society and also different poverty levels.
Right.
And these are diseases we hadn't even read about in textbooks.
Yes.
So it was a very big challenge. And often we were the first doctors they ever saw. That was another problem. You know, at best, one or two preliminary consultation, they must have said, we can't do anything, go somewhere else, or something like that. So the challenges are very different. And I have also heard some doctors telling me that the patients were so undernourished that they couldn't operate on them. So they would admit them and first bring them to a certain level of nourishment.
Right.
So that they could tolerate the surgery.
Right.
That was something which I had never heard of before.
Right. Sometimes we have to fatten up our patients literally before they can go through an operation, because they need a certain amount of reserve, amount of strength to go through an operation well. There are certain unique challenges working in a hospital that focus on care of the poor. Social challenges, nutritional challenges, being able to afford certain types of medications after the operation is done. Even being able to travel back for follow-up care, because having a surgery is one part of the patient's care, but there's still a long-term care that is required after some certain types of interventions. So those are unique challenges. Now, within that system, we have a setup of several hundred physicians from all over the country who see our patients after they're discharged for free for many months afterwards. And they're able to follow up with us, communicate with us about the patient, so that even if the patient's not able to come back physically, at least we can help.
Yeah, that I heard.
So that we can adjust or assist.
Follow-up is something very interesting.
Follow-up is very important. The other thing we do is we counsel the patients not only on things like nutrition and hygiene, but even things like stress management, dealing with anger, dealing with emotional toxicities, alcoholism, smoking addictions, and other things that are common in every society, in every strata of society, but in a way that is easy for them to understand. And I think that makes a big difference. I think what you'll see in Swami's hospital is very interesting. In Swami's hospital, you see that patients are crying when they leave the hospital. Where in most hospitals, people cry when they get admitted to the hospital. Why are they crying?
We are running the movie backwards.
They say, "Doctor, I've been to so many hospitals. I've seen so many doctors, but I've never received as much love and kindness as I have from all the staff here." That is a distinction. It is high quality care. Yes, it is offered free of cost, but it is offered with love and compassion. I think that is what makes it so wonderful to work in Swami's institution. That love, that sweetness, it's the honey that that underlies everything that's done there.
Dr. Michael Nobel of the Nobel Foundation is the great grandnephew of Alfred Nobel, who established the Nobel Prize. He has come here a few times. And we also interviewed him, I think, if I remember correctly. But anyway, he has been interviewed many times. And he made a very interesting remark about Swami's hospital. He's been involved with the medical healthcare business because he was connected with a company that sold equipment, medical equipment. And he said, "I've seen many hospitals all over the world. I've seen high-tech hospitals. I've seen charity hospitals. But I've never seen a high-tech charity hospital." This is very unique.
Yes.
Another remark he made, which was very interesting, he said, if you go to Europe, at the entrance you will have a photograph of the president or the king of the country.
Mm-hmm.
In Sweden, we have the photograph of the king of Sweden right at the entrance. But in Baba's hospital, I found a photograph in every ward. And I was thinking about it, then I realized that those photos are very reassuring to the patients.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, the love that emanates and the sort of resonance between the photo and the patient makes the patient recover faster than in other places.
Yes, because it's a divine environment. It's a divine, supercharged environment, really. But if you look at that quality, again, going back to what we said earlier, most people relate charity hospitals to low-quality hospitals, and unfortunately, most people relate quality to luxury, which is not correct. There are many luxurious places which actually quality is pretty bad.
No.
But in Swami's hospital, you have this tremendous quality. If you look at our mortality, cardiac surgery, neurosurgery, it's 1% or less, which is comparable to, say, 3 to 4% for other hospitals around the world which are taking care of similar complexities in their patients. If you look at our infection rate after surgery, If you look at countries like the United States, South Korea, which have the best infection rates in the world, it's around 3.5 to 4.5%. If you look at Western European countries, it's around 6 to 8%. And if you look at developing countries, including India, it's anywhere from 12 to 18%. But if you look at Satya Sai Hospital, the super specialty hospitals, our infection rate is only 3%. And that too, given the malnutrition, given the patient's poor understanding of complex surgical issues, given so many things, that's amazing. That's just amazing.
What is it the result of?
Superb care. Superb care. Everybody takes personal interest. I remember Swami once said, he said, "Don't think that this is Swami's hospital. Think that this is our hospital." And that's the feeling that we have, that we're all working together. Many times we have physicians who come from abroad to visit us, to lend their expertise and skills. And we're very grateful because it gives us a chance to learn the latest in medical care for that particular specialty, and we all benefit. And they all say, the way in which everyone is working so hard to improve the patient's standing, the way that everyone is working together, they don't see that at other hospitals. There's no ego saying, "I want to do this my way," or "you can't do it that way, we have to do it this way." That doesn't happen. We're always looking at what is best for the patient, and that is what happens. That's what we look for.
In the year 2000, in September, my wife was admitted in the super specialty hospital here. She was terminally ill, and Swami said, "Take her there." And she was there for 40 days or so, and then she passed away. So I was there most of the time because we were just two alone, and I would spend many nights to be near her and so on. Of course, my sister came, and so we would take turns. Her sister came, and we distributed the load. But that is not the point that I'm trying to tell you. There were a lot of sevadals, as always, and they used to take turns. There was one guy who was something like a comic. He would come and try to entertain my wife. She was having pain and all that in Hindi. And he was a funny character. But on the last day, he went around crying. He said, "What happened to him?" He was crying because he had to leave.
Oh.
That was very strange. I mean, he really loved being there. And he said, "Now my dream is coming to an end. I have to go. I have to go back to my work. What a horrible place that is," and so on and so forth. It was really very touching. Another thing I wanted to mention is that in the very early days, especially in this hospital, you know, at that time in 1991, Puttaparthi itself was a village. I remember Dr. Safaya telling us that during the construction time, they would go out for tea to a hut just on the other side of the road. It's the road that leads to Brahmanapalli.
Right.
This other road, airport road, was getting built at that time, along with the airport. The airport and the hospital came almost together. The airport beat the hospital by a few days because the Prime Minister had to land for the inauguration of the hospital. The point is, in those days, the people who came were very poor. And I remember doctors telling me that if they ask a patient, "What's your address?" they didn't know how to give the address. You go to a remote hamlet, there are half a dozen houses, there are no streets with names and all that.
Right.
People know where everybody in the village know where, who lives where.
Right. Right.
Now, when he comes here and the doctor says, "I want a postal address so that I can write to you," first of all, he speaks in a dialect that is not understood by the doctors.
Right.
And luckily, if there are people who know the language, then it makes it slightly different. But he said, "Babu, tell me your address," and all that. He will say, "My address is next to that of so-and-so, who is the village minister," and things like that. How do you write a postcard to him saying, your daughter's surgery is fixed for this day?
But these are all practical issues that we have to look at. It's taking care of the patient as a whole, not just the
very
disease.
Very tough, very tough.
I remember Swami once told us, he said, when you're taking care of a patient, don't just treat the illness. Look into why they got sick. How did they get sick? And take care of that as well. So when I'm taking care of a patient who comes to me with heart pain, chest pain, let's say, and it's coming from the heart, I often look into not only is their sugar control, do they have diabetes, do they smoke, is their weight okay, blood pressure is all right, the usual medical things. We look at the holistic aspect. Is there anger under control? Are they able to manage their stress appropriately? What are they doing to we all have stress. It's there in different levels for everyone. How are they managing with that? How are they coping? Are they able to control their senses in a way that is appropriate for their situation? These are all things that we look at as well. So it becomes a very holistic way. Now, treatment is good, but then you have to look at how are you treating the patients. And I'll say that in Bangalore, we're very lucky because we're constantly updating our equipment. We have, in fact, just bought a new cath lab. We're purchasing another brand new cath lab. We just got a new set of echo machines that are the first in India. First in India, the most advanced echo machines for diagnosis of heart disease that is possible. And we're now getting ready to purchase a brand new MRI scanner that will again be the first in India, the most advanced technology that is available. And we'll be able to do tremendous work for our patients with that. So we're talking about quality, but you have to understand that this is the best quality that is currently available at the time. This is what we use for treating our patients.
I remember Dr. Iyer describing a case he handled many, many years ago, in the early years. There was a young girl of 7 or 8 or 9 maybe. She was brought to the hospital. She was in a terrible condition. And they examined and it looked as if she was going to die in another 10 minutes. So he found there was no heart problem. And then what has happened was there was fluid in the lungs. If you take that out, it'll be all right. So there was an issue whether she should be admitted or not. Because she didn't have a heart problem. So Dr. Iyer said, nonsense, we have to save her life and we have to do something. And then they removed the fluid and she was all right. Then he tried to find out what was the problem. Basically, he looked at her, she had long nails. And then he talked to the parents. They used to take bath once in 15 days. Mm-hmm. And there was total lack of cleanliness just in the village across the river, Karnataka Nagapalli. And it was their lifestyle that produced the infection.
Mm-hmm.
And he had to give a long lecture on how to be clean and
yes.
so on and so
yes.
forth. It nearly caused a death, he said. So ignorance plays a big part. Apart from poverty.
And this is a large part of what we do. Before we see every patient, we have different teams of counselors. Some focus on the psychosocial aspect. Some focus just on hygiene. Our nutritionists come and speak to the patients about what type of foods to eat, given their local availability, given their income and so
Many
forth. This is all
too
part
poor
of good care. Many of them are so poor. How are they going to afford to eat high-quality protein, especially for a growing child? So we look at ways in which we can provide them that or that they can get that on their own after they leave the hospital. Once they're in Swami's hospital, it's no problem. We take care of them. We make them nice and plump before they leave. But after they leave, we still have to support them so that they're good quality care is done. We don't want all of our hard work to be undone because of poor social circumstances afterwards.
Okay, now I have to ask you the mandatory question. Tell me about one tough case that you handled, which was very tough, but it got through by Swami's grace.
You know, sometimes when you had a difficult patient, someone comes before you, say in the emergency room, and you're talking to them, you're trying to work them up, and then they just collapse right before you. You know that they have a heart attack. They need treatment right away. And you're doing your best to whisk them upstairs to the cath lab to get the treatment that they need so that their blocked artery can be open and they can get blood flow back to their heart. So there have been times where a patient comes in gasping with chest pain and then collapses, basically is dead, clinically dead. Somehow, with Swami's grace, we're able to resuscitate them. The recovery rate from such events are generally pretty poor. See, I can perhaps restore the pulse. I can restore a blood pressure. But what happens during that time that we're doing CPR and all the other events is that blood flow to the brain is not sufficient and a patient comes out with brain damage. So although they may be physically alive, they're what we would call a vegetable. So these type cases I've seen, the patient comes out fine. Just as they were. I don't know if they're better, but certainly they're just fine as they were beforehand. That is amazing. When we see a patient that we give up for dead, but yet somehow we're able to save them and bring them back. That is Swami's grace. You know when you see that, it's nothing that we could have possibly done, but it's Swami's grace that made that possible.
Okay, now I'll change the gear completely and go to a slightly general plane, if I may. That has got to do with the fact that you worked once in America. American healthcare has been very much in the news for a number of reasons, including the fact that the Supreme Court ruled on it in a very convoluted way. I'm sure you must have heard about the Supreme Court judgment, the outbursts and so on and so forth. But that doesn't concern me. What I would like you to tell me and our listeners and viewers is something about the kind of healthcare system that is prevalent there, which is very expensive and yet does not deliver the goods in the manner that many people expect it. Some people praise it to the skies, but a lot of people feel deprived and even cheated. There is something that is not very level over there.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to get some idea of that system, which is good at one end but not so good at the other end, so that we can place Swami's hospitals in a certain context.
Right. It's a good question. I think that in every society, you will see a certain segment of society which falls ill for various reasons. And so for those people, you need very advanced, high-quality care so that you can take care of them. The U.S. has that. It has extremely high quality. You'll see the best of the best healthcare, the best of the best research, teaching, education, for whether it's not only physicians but nurses, technologists. It's just wonderful. But then, you know, every now and then I'll get magazines and journals updating alumni of the former institutions where I studied. And I'll see that one such institution had just opened up a 280,000 square foot cancer center for that particular region, which is wonderful, really. But then at the same time, I'm wondering, why is it that we're having so much cancer that we need a 280,000 square foot facility to take care of them? Why is it that we're having so much heart disease when the cure or the preventative tools for those are so widely available? Why is it that we're not able to deal with basic things such as smoking, alcohol abuse, inactivity, obesity, diabetes, and so forth? What I feel we have to go towards is a more preventative type of approach. Swami told us again many times, he says, work for prevention. It's not enough just to take care of those who are sick. You must go out and teach others how to prevent themselves from getting sick in the first place. And this is a key component. Yes, there are certainly a lot of good efforts made in prevention. In fact, in cardiology, you have a whole discipline just dedicated towards preventive cardiology. But it's often looking at things like blood pressure, diabetes, and so forth. We need to look at the whole factor.
But is it not connected with the lifestyle itself?
Yes, it is. It is the lifestyle. But the lifestyle comes from where? Is it an external lifestyle where you're looking at your cell phone, your iPad, your computer, you're sitting in front of your TV all day? What is it that's keeping people from being active, from being healthy?
But I also see people hyperactive and stressed out. Either you get from inaction, sitting in front of the TV and gulping bags of potato chips, or you are running around all the time, hardly any sleep, kicking around in the office and trying to make bucks for your boss.
Right. That comes from one simple thing, in my opinion, and that is a focus on happiness through external means. We're never taught that real happiness is found inside of yourself. As soon as you are born, you're bombarded, or your parents are bombarded, even before you're born, with advertisements saying that in order to be a good parent, you have to buy this and this and this and this for your child, whether it's a crib that they will never use, or fancy blankets and bed sheets, toys that they will never understand because of their age, etc., etc. And this goes on through our entire life, where we're always taught, you need to buy this to make you look beautiful. You need to buy this to make you look...
I think, you know what is going to happen? Very soon you will have these machines that examine mothers, which have got a little chip embedded there which sends commercials to the newborn baby, advertising before you're born.
As long as you're looking outside of yourself, you will always be disappointed. There is no contentment in external things. It is only from within that contentment and happiness is found. And so this is where society needs to change. We need to stop brainwashing ourselves that external products or commercial activities will give us happiness. They're necessary, sure. We need a car, we need a place to live, we need clothes to wear. But do we really need to replace them as frequently as we have? There's a recent study in the United Kingdom, for example, which showed that the number of clothes that are sitting in the closets of the people of the UK exceeds some $230 billion. That's a lot of money that could be used for elsewhere. That's basically
UK.
Clothes that people have bought and not used. United Kingdom.
Kingdom?
Yes.
Oh, well, it
yes.
must be much more in US. Okay. I leave the last word to you. You can say what you would like to tell our listeners and viewers, and we will together say goodbye.
Sure.
So, over to you.
The last word is always love. The last word is always love. And I think it starts with loving yourself. Because if you don't love yourself, you won't be able to love others.
What do you
others.
Mean by loving myself?
Loving
myself.
Yourself. What we usually do is we beat ourselves up. We say, I'm no good. I'm not good enough.
Well, a lot of guys say, I'm the smartest. I'm the greatest.
That is ego. That is ego. Loving yourself, not in an egoistic or narcissistic or selfish way, but loving yourself as a child of God. As Swami's divine creation. And as that divine creation, you are inherently divine, which means you are beautiful, you are gorgeous, you are worthy of all good things in life. What we do is we tend to put ourselves down. We say, I'm not good enough. I don't deserve this. I deserve to be beaten up, whether verbally or physically, by my spouse or my friends or my family or whatever it is. I deserve to not have enough. But when we love ourselves as God loves us, then the divinity in ourselves can be revealed. We have to love so that when we love ourselves, we share that love with everything else in creation. And it's this love that is the first and the last thing. That is what matters. Love and love alone.
Thank you. Thank you very much on behalf of our studio and our listeners.
Thank you, sir.
God bless you. Sai.
Thank you. Sai Ram.
You were listening to a conversation with Dr. Srikant Sola, an eminent cardiologist serving at the Sri Satya Sai Institute of Higher Medical Sciences, Whitefield, Bangalore. And in conversation with him was Professor J. Venkatraman, the former Vice Chancellor of the Sri Satya Sai Institute of Higher Learning. Dear listeners, you may send in your feedback to listener@radiosai.org. Thank you, Sai Ram.
सोहम सोहम ध्यान करो साई ध्यान करो
सतगुरु साई ध्यान करो
सतगुरु साई ध्यान करो
सतगुरु साई ध्यान करो
सोहम सोहम ध्यान करो
ध्यान करो
सो हम साई ध्यान करो
Shri पर की आशा।
गिरिधर बाला हे नंदलाला,
गिरिधर बाला हे नंदलाला,
गिरिधर बाला हे नंदलाला,
गिरिधर बाला हे नंदलाला।
देवकी नंदन श्याम गोपाला,
देवकी
नंदन श्याम गोपाला, गिरिधर बाला श्याम
गोपाला,
केशव माधव श्याम
गोपाला,
श्याम गोपाला, श्याम साई गोपाला, गिरिधर बाला हे नंदलाला।